Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives, where you can listen to every episode we've ever done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is October 22nd, 2020, and my guest is philosopher and author Daniel Habron of St. Louis University. He's the author of Happiness, A Very Short Introduction, which is our topic for today. I want to thank Plantronics for providing today's guest with the Blackwire 5220 headset. And I want to remind listeners you can now get Econ Talk merchandise with our new logo at russroberts.info. Russroberts.info. Please wear it proudly. Dan, welcome to Econ Talk.
Thank you, Russ. Thanks for having me on.
Happiness, which is the title of your book. It's also the subtitle I like, A Very Short Introduction. It is very short, but it's still an extremely lovely book. I very much enjoyed it. But that title, Happiness, is what Marvin Minsky called a suitcase word. We might think we know what it means, but a lot of people stuff different things inside the suitcase. How would you start to define what you mean by happiness?
Yeah, I've sometimes called it a mongrel concept, a similar idea, and it does have different meanings. So before getting into definitions, I always want to know what people care about and why they're interested in happiness to find out what meaning of it makes the most sense in a given situation. Because there's different legitimate ways to use the word, and nobody really owns it. So the short story is, I think for most of the purposes when we talk about how happy someone is or unhappy or whether people are happier today than they were 30 years ago, we have in mind a psychological concept that I think is mostly about a person's emotional state. So when I want to avoid the confusion of the word happiness, I'll call it emotional well-being. And in that sense, you can think of happiness as roughly the opposite of anxiety and depression. But again, there's other legitimate uses of the term. Sometimes people use it the word originally came out of the Old English for good hap, so good fortune. And what's really interesting is in so many languages you find a word that would translate happiness in that sense. So eudaimonia in ancient Greek, gluck in German, and so forth, have these terms for basically good fortune. And then it would be a very interesting project to see to what extent you see in different languages that it eventually developed into more of a psychological notion as it has, I think, in contemporary English. But there's still some of that old residue.
But your book's about a lot more than just emotional well-being. You have a richer concept of happiness. Talk about what else you are considering in there.
So the hard thing about writing a book like that is that I knew people would pick it up, like you said, the suitcase concept, and a different idea of what they want to find inside. And so for a lot of people, they're really more interested in what matters in life. I ended up making the book sort of about happiness, no matter how you think about it. And so that it's really more ultimately about a good life. And so for my Aristotelian friends, who really are more interested in the concept of happiness as a good life or flourishing, they get something out of it too. And one of the things I wanted to do is try to show how no matter what your views are, whether you agree with Aristotle or more modern writers like Jeremy Bentham or John Stuart Mill, we all ultimately care about a lot of the same things, like virtue and being happy in the psychological sense, like emotional well-being. But I agree, in terms of what Aristotle was talking about and a lot of the ancients, to me, happiness is one part of a good life. It's an important part of a good life. Sometimes people underrate it. Sometimes people overrate it. And so that was part of the project, is to kind of put that in context.
Yeah, well, we'll get to the other parts of it in our conversation. But when you mention Bentham and Mill, inevitably I think about utilitarianism, which I also hope to talk about, but I want to start, we'll get there via maybe economics.
Okay.
Isn't it a little bit strange that the modern economist sees well-being as being provided by the stuff you buy and consume? You know, in modern economics, your utility, which is a vague, even better suitcase word than happiness, it means, and Bentham, you know, describes it in different ways, advantage, benefit, pleasure. Economists do the same thing. In fact, economists define it circularly. Utility is whatever gives you utility. It's whatever you do, that's evidently what you like, and that's what you want more of. But it often boils down in an undergraduate class, and even in a graduate class, to the stuff you buy and consume. And I think most people would agree that well-being, happiness, satisfaction doesn't come from stuff.
I'd agree, and I think the history of how that came about is really interesting. But I think there was a lot to it originally, where, you know, in 1800 and in not in 1900, material prosperity was really important to improve basically anything about well-being.
Yeah, true.
It made sense for people to focus heavily on material things, and we also, I think it just comes naturally to people to focus on stuff and money. It's very easy to do that. It's tangible. We can all point to it and see it. But then what we found is, well, okay, now we've taken care of. Most of us aren't hungry now. Most of us have, I mean, of course, there are a lot of exceptions around the world, and material prosperity is still a really important thing to focus on. But yeah, we're kind of seeing now, especially I think at the post-war period, post-World War II, that just adding more stuff isn't really, it's nice. I mean, I could always use a raise. I won't complain. But it really, you know, it's not that important in the scheme of things. And we start seeing more like, okay, are we trading off relationships or other things that we care about more that are, at least for people like us, are more important. Actually, in general, relationships are about as important as anything can be for happiness.
Well, that's a nice transition to one of my favorite Adam Smith quotes, not the one in the Econ Talk drinking game for listeners who are familiar with that, but a variant on that. Smith said in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, quote, if the chief part of human happiness arises from the consciousness of being beloved, as I believe it does, those sudden changes of fortune seldom contribute much to happiness. There's really two parts to that quote, obviously. The first part is a very dramatic claim that the chief part of human happiness arises from the consciousness of being beloved, which means relationships that you alluded to. And then the second thing he says is that raise is not going to help you much. Can you react to that Smith quote?
Yeah. I one of these days, I'd love to teach a grad seminar on Adam Smith because he was brilliant and he gets caricatured as just being about greed and selfishness,
horrible,
which is completely not what he was about. And you really see, so there's a phenomenon. One of the first things I encountered that got me into studying happiness was research indicating how quickly, for instance, people would adapt to changes in their material circumstances and in most circumstances in life. We're very resilient creatures. There's one way of looking at it. But we're also kind of on the move. We're constantly, so something changes and then we kind of get over it. And this is, my wife went to business school, and I remember the classmates would sometimes say, well, you know, I'm not going to go for that kind of job because I know I'm not going to be happy. It's really, you know, insane hours and everything. It's a total treadmill. And I know the money is not that important. But then they saw the signing bonus that they offered. and you know, we have this, sometimes called the focusing illusion, or, you know, where you tend to focus on or the impact bias. You focus on the initial impact of a change. And getting that signing bonus, people correctly guess that that feels really good. And then and first getting that car, the new Porsche or whatever it is you want, or Tesla, I wouldn't mind one of those. And then you forget that, then we just project that too far into the future. And in fact, we tend to adapt. And we don't adapt totally to everything. And that's, in recent years, we've gotten a clear understanding that certain things like unemployment, bad relationships, I think generally stressful situations are often, you know, if you're in a precarious financial situation, it's hard to adapt to that. But in general, we're pretty adaptable. And I think Adam Smith nailed that.
You say life is not a gymnastics routine. What do you mean by that? Or happiness? Did you say life or happy? I apologize. I meant to.
No, life is. Yeah. So
life is not a gymnastics routine. That's what I think you're right.
Yeah. So, and that's where thinking about when I first started working on this, I just accepted that psychologists mostly defined happiness as being satisfied with your life, an attitude, a judgment about your life, and I just thought that was obviously true. And then I started seeing the research. I'm like, well, I'm not sure if these judgments are quite as important as we might have thought, because it's so easy to influence them. And then when you really think about it, how would you rate your life on a scale from 0 to 10? Well, again, that's like asking you to sum up everything in your life that you care about. And, you know, I still don't know how to answer that question. I mean, I'll give you an answer.
Yeah.
And it'll generally be in the positive end of the range because, well, for one thing, I am actually quite lucky. But also, if I don't have to tell people I'm unhappy, I'm not going to.
And you're probably a little delusional too. So, you know, I'm an 8.8, I'd say, on a scale of 1 to 10.
Yeah.
And I probably just don't think much about the parts that would drag me down to a 4.
Yeah, and it really is just so, well, so there's things in the big picture like people in your life that who are no longer living, well, that really stinks. Or maybe you don't like the kind of culture your children are growing up in, or really big picture stuff are there are certain things about our general way of life that I'm not that thrilled with. But if you just ask me, you know, I'm not normally sitting around worrying about that or complaining about that. And so there's just, it's apples and oranges, basically, all over the place. It's just because on the one hand, I care about doing good philosophy, being a good philosopher. I also want to be a good teacher. I want to be a good parent. I want to have fun travel experiences, like the Sicily trip we recently canceled for obvious reasons. I like my dog. I'm not so crazy about my computer all the time, but, and how do you add all that up? And just in a way, there's not really any point. Even a gymnastics routine is hard to put a single number on. So it's a little arbitrary. And what that means, we have a lot of freedom in how we answer that question. So I could give my life a 4 if I think about it like if I really want to focus on the negative stuff enough. Or I could give it an 8 or a 9, you know. So it's a little bit of a coin toss. And so I think we just have to be careful in thinking in how we understand when people give a rating to their life. You know, it's really a simplification.
So when you said that, like when you read that, when I read it, I like to say sometimes, you know, I'm writing a book on this, so it's a little bit frightening to see the synergy here. You know, I write life's not a calculus problem, even though economists sometimes treat it like it is. And I think there's two senses in which life is not a gymnastics routine. One sense is that it's hard to sum it up. And I actually use the same metaphor of apples and oranges. I mean, how do you weigh the annoying fact that before we started this interview, my computer was really unhappy and I was getting a little frustrated and you're sitting there thinking, I wonder if this is going to happen. How do I weigh that against the fact that I have 4 healthy children? Talk about apples and oranges, but I can give the number. And because I give the number, people go, oh, well, you can do it. Well, you can, but what's it? Does it mean anything? I mean, really. And then the second part, which I think is equally important, is that, you know, if you have a gymnastics routine coming up, you want to practice it a lot. You want to decide what's going to be in it. You're going to very carefully pick the music to make sure that it synced nicely with the routine, and that make sure the judges like that music. And the idea that somehow you can plan your life like a gymnastics routine or like a giant algorithm stretching forward, I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding of what creates a good life. And when we talk later about, and for those listeners, by the way, are thinking, you know, I don't want to hear all this stuff about happiness. Don't hit the stop button, because we're going to talk about what creates a good life, and Dan is going to reveal what creates a good life, and you don't want to miss that. I just want to build up the anticipation for that. And I'm kind of joking, Dan. I can see you appreciate that, but I'm also kind of serious, because there's a lot of, I think there's some really interesting analytical things we're talking about now, but I think there are also some deeper, even spiritual things that we'll talk about later. But here's my problem now that we've both agreed that life is not a gymnastics routine. At the same time, you write, and I don't know why you do, but you say, measuring happiness is no more mysterious or fraught than measuring depression or anxiety, and it should be no more controversial. Really? I thought you just told me you can't really measure it.
I'm putting the point a little strongly there, I'll admit, because I'm wanting to, because there are problems with measuring depression or anxiety also.
Yes, there are.
Mental health measures. But those tend to be general, there's less skepticism about those. And there's a lot of evidence that the measures usefully predict all sorts of things and are actually useful measures. I think measures of emotional well-being, it's really just, so I'm validating a new measure that a psychologist and I, David Yaden and I, have developed, kind of working with psychology and philosophy together, essentially we started out kind of mostly, I just pirated questions from depression and anxiety and stress questionnaires, and then just put a bunch of stuff out there, and made sure that things that were talked about in the theory were at least tried out and to see what stuck. It seems like it really does track a reality. It really does track things like stressors in life, quality of relationships. It tracks at least to a strong degree, it tracks the sorts of things you would want a measure like that to track. So there's good reason to think, like when people say, if one person says they feel really anxious most of the time, and one person says they feel really relaxed most of the time, on average, the second person is going to be more relaxed and the first person is going to be more anxious. There's definitely going to be biases, and I've written about all sorts of mistakes people can make. Like I think my wife is probably the best happiness measure for me. If I want to know how happy I am, I ask her, and she'll be like, yeah, no, you've been kind of grumpy lately, or, you know, like, oh, okay, yeah, you're right. So they're imperfect. And I would be very cautious in using one of these measures to tell how happy one person is. But when you do it over larger numbers in studies or over population, it seems to give you pretty good data on relative levels.
How would you know?
I think it's good enough. It's worth using.
How would you know? I mean, I've told the story before, probably on Econ Talk, but my Russian friend, when I ask him how's it going, he says, fine, like all Americans. Because that's our answer, first of all. Fine is our answer, which means, I heard your question, let's have a conversation. It doesn't mean I'm fine, usually. It just means it's part of the banter of daily life. How are you? I'm fine. But Russians don't say fine because they're different. And every culture has their own differences. So, you know, when people say that Scandinavians are happier than whoever's. I don't even. Is there, I mean, I think that's a meaningless statement. Defend. Do you want to defend it? And by the way, that statement, Scandinavians are happier than other people, comes out of survey data where people are asked subjective questions, either a question or a set of questions.
I think it's the data out there are suggestive. It seems like, and in general, even across nationally, so you look at the World Happiness Reports over since 2012, that they come out annually. They do a remarkably plausible job of, the thing is people doing better on the measure tend to be doing better on all sorts of other things you would expect. And at this point, this is the main way you tell whether these measures are good is, do they track the things you'd expect? One thing I like about the happiness, emotional well-being type measures, and I disagree with my economist friends somewhat on this, is they don't track the political economic variables like money and quality of governance as well as life satisfaction. But they do track things like relationships, having autonomy on a daily basis, having friends you can count on, and being able to do what you do best. The sorts of things you might intuitively think are pretty important for how happy a person is, they track those things pretty strongly, whereas life satisfaction tends to track material conditions more strongly. I actually think that's a reason to take both kind of measures seriously. Cross-culturally, I mean, between any two countries, I take the Scandinavian thing with a big grain of salt because I think the evidence is strong enough, like robust enough, that there's probably something to it. If only, and what my friends who in psychology have done a lot of the studies says it looks like mostly what it is there's less misery, perhaps. Now there is, interesting the data about high depression or suicide rates, which is another question. To me, the biggest, I'm in this interesting position where on one hand, I think the data are good enough that we should be looking at the science and we should be using it to help us move beyond just counting money and policy and other material variables. At the same time, I get really worried when people get overconfident in the measures because there's a lot we still don't know, like the idea of just assessing all policies by life satisfaction, cost effectiveness analysis on life satisfaction. No one measure is that powerful. And between cultures, and the Russian example you gave, that's one of my favorite examples. Not that exact one used, but yeah, Russians have a very different culture and way of thinking about emotions. People in Japan, maybe you might find people reporting lower levels of anger because there's just stronger taboos. Anger is an interesting one, and one that I did not focus on so much in the measure we're working on, because I feel like culturally there's such strong norms that are very different between cultures about anger. So Ed Diener had an interesting experience. He was he's a friend of mine. I think he's a brilliant psychologist. And they were talking to a farmer in Africa. I think it might have been Kenya, but and they were trying to get out, have you been angry, in the last week? Were you angry yesterday? Like, no, I don't think so. No. Did you get in a fight? I hit somebody yesterday. it's just the way people think about their well-being and emotional lives, it's just going to be different between cultures. And so, so I think we have to be very careful comparing between cultures. But just to give another example that is there's a lot of evidence, Latin American countries, especially around the Caribbean basin, tend to report relatively high levels of happiness. Now, we also know that there's tendencies, there's a kind of positive thinking strain to the culture is one of the reasons people like me really like to go down there.
Yeah.
And so how much of that is just the bias, positivity bias being really strong there? Now, Americans also have a really strong positivity bias compared to, say, Russians or people in China. So a grant that we ran a few years ago funded a study of several countries in Latin America done out of Costa Rica and Mexico. And they looked at Colombia, Costa Rica, Mexico. I think those were the countries. But they didn't just look at the subjective well-being reports like life satisfaction and emotion, but also things like really detailed look at people's relationships. And what you saw, what they concluded is that faith, the religious faith, seemed to make a real difference, be a real booster for it. But also, it just the data points really suggested when you looked at different aspects of their lives that despite the government corruption and the violence, and in Mexico at least, not so much, and the poverty, and these aren't really poor countries by global standards, perhaps, but compared to the U.S., that they really seem to be, yeah, they actually seem to be pretty high, doing pretty well in terms of happiness. And in terms of relationships, it was really striking how much denser and warmer and more frequent people's social relationships and interactions were, say, in Mexico than in the U.S.
So I'm open to that. I'm open to that possibility. Yeah. That I'll say it a different way. I think there are things that would make me happier than other things. So the question is, how do I find out what they are that might be under my control, right? One of them is, one of my favorite lines, no one on their deathbed wish they spent more time at the office. Mm-hmm. So you could argue that, you know, when you're faced with a choice between working the extra Sunday versus staying home with your family or doing something special with your wife or a group of friends, choose the friends, the wife, the family, and don't choose the job. Try to build, I think it's good advice to think about crafting a network of friendships and what is required to make that happen. That's an art and a craft that most of us don't think about systematically or at all. And as I get older, I think about whether I spent enough time on that, whether I have devoted enough time to my friendships and sustaining those relationships. So I think those are valuable things to think about. What appalls me about that research in general, and I'll let you react to this, is the idea that somehow policy could help the United States become more like Guatemala or more like Denmark, or that we could be happier as a nation. And I think through some policy, forget the cross-country comparisons. Let's just say we monitor happiness year in, year out in the United States, and then we try to figure out through statistical techniques what leads to a higher score. And I think a lot of people think that's a legitimate exercise and a good idea. I think it's an appalling idea because, first of all, I don't think the goal of life is to maximize happiness. It's not a gymnastics routine. Secondly, I don't think the government is going to be good at figuring out what those things are, nor are the statisticians. And so I'm kind of left, and I'll let you defend the alternative, I'm kind of left arguing that, believing that happiness surveys, satisfaction with life surveys are good for generating academic research. I don't think they're important for figuring out how to be happy and or how to run government policy. You know, in particular, a lot of the Adam Smith kind of got onto this in 1759 about being beloved, friendships, what people think of you. I'm sure it's in the Bible. I can't pull up a quote right now, but I there's nothing new under the sun in this area. Mostly, I think we kind of have a pretty good understanding of it. And the attempt of modern academics to refine and perfect these measures strikes me as something like a fool's errand or worse. What do you think?
So I have a little bit more sanguine view of the role of policy here. It's funny, I was just in my ethics class teaching several readings that referred to Hayek and sort of the limitations of policy and problems of, and it was one thing I worry about is you start trying to promote something in policy, then special interests can capture the policy levers and yeah. steer it in their direction. Yeah, so, and I think this is really important questions to keep in mind. I'm optimistic, though, that there are, at this point, we still need to figure it out. The most important thing that I think for policy that the science can do is just really for the public mind and the culture, is help us change the lens through which we think about how our society is doing and where we want to go. I think that's, rather than equipping policymakers to say, okay, we're going to choose this policy over that because the data shows that that's going to boost subjective well-being more. For one thing, as you said, subjective well-being is a good thing to boost, but there are other things we care about. So we don't want to just maximize that. And I get very grumpy when academics just say, oh, we know that all that really matters is happiness, subjective well-being, and policy should just be about maximizing that. And like, well, most people disagree with you, most of the citizens. So, yeah. You know, like you gotta, and ultimately this all policy, all, to my mind, within the bounds of liberty, basically, like in the U.S. it would be the Constitution or in similar principles, it should be driven by citizens' values, what we ultimately care about. And so policy should not be trying to foist a particular idea of happiness or well-being or good life on people. And so policy for New York City should probably look pretty different than policy for Louisiana. They have different values, you know. In Louisiana, they like a slower pace of life, and they might like things that make it easier to not, you know, to be more laid back. And whereas in New York, people want to accomplish more, people are more interested, you know, they're achievers, and they might like the fast pace of life. They might like working long hours and so forth, and they may want to make that trade-off. But I think there are still... if you just get the lens in place, okay, we're not just about trying to maximize economic growth or in other economic variables, then I think you get that itself. I think that cultural change, and to my mind, and the main thing that I'm interested in is working as a writer, as a philosopher, is move us toward a healthier culture, I think, where we're pursuing a way of life that better fits our values, really, that we already have. I don't think most people's fundamental values are really that materialistic to begin with. But there are, I think, the popular culture sometimes doesn't give people, in a way, permission.
Yeah.
And in fact, once a couple of years ago, a young man wrote to me, and he was like, basically facing a dilemma. He's like, well, I could do this easy thing where I make more money and everything and I'd be happier, but I really want to write music and make films. And I know that's going to be really hard and, you know, it's going to be a struggle. And I was like, well, here's the thing. A lot of philosophers, I can't give you advice, but a lot of philosophers would say it can make perfect sense to pursue other values in life than just happiness. And you might reasonably choose meaning or excellence or beauty. And I like to, more recently, I've started using Alex Honnold, the climber of Free Solo, yeah, who climbed right. El Capitan. And he said in the documentary about him, he said, I'm not after happiness, I'm after excellence. And I think I'm not sure his choices have necessarily been the most prudent, but I mean, he's kind of wired a little differently from the rest of us, but I that's part of what drives me. I didn't become a philosopher to be the happiest. Yeah. I used to work in the tech industry.
I think it's greatly overrated. Part of my theme of this program, and it's a part of your book as well. I think we've spent a little too much time maybe on this question of measurement, and because I'm interested in it, but it's not the central part of your book, and it's just one part. But you mentioned Alex. Is it Honnold? Is that his last name?
Yeah.
So I got to see him speak one time where he lived out of his car for quite a while because he wanted to just – he didn't have a lot of money. He didn't want a job. He wanted to climb. He wanted to be excellent. So he worked at that. And most of us would say living out of your car is hell. I don't think he felt that way. He may have preferred not to live out of his car for a while. But after he got really good at climbing and after he – free soloed El Capitan or whatever else he did. Now he's very wealthy. He has a lot of money. And what he said when I heard him speak, I don't know if he's lived up to this, but that's not really relevant. Well, it's a little relevant actually, but so let's assume it's true. He said, I sat down and I thought, how much of my money do I really need? And he said, 50% is a lot. So he decided to give away, I think if I remember correctly, and I'll try to find a link to something he's done. He decided to create a foundation to try to make the world a better place. Lovely idea, hard to do, but not an enterprise worth working on. We'd all agree, even if it's just working on ourselves. But if you have a lot of money, it could work maybe to help other people. And he decided to put 50% of his income in that. Maybe it's more. I don't even remember. Maybe it's 30 or 50. It was a giant number compared to what most people put away for other people in other giving. And, I think beside the obvious point that helping others makes you feel good sometimes, he also was not wired to, I think, to have fun particularly, or to have material fun. And I think you use an image in your book, which I love, a stomach on legs. Most of us agree that being a stomach on legs, just satisfying yourself physically through your senses, I mean, it's pleasant at times and inevitably important at other times, but can't be the goal of life. It's got to be something, more than that. Not got to be, but most of us, as you say, have a value of something more than that, whether it's meaning, contributing, connecting to others. And maybe it's a good segue. You can react to what I said if you want, but also I want you to talk about an image I really like in your book, a choice between being a consumer versus an appreciator. And I think that's a fantastically important distinction I'd never heard before. So you can react to what I said, but then I want you to talk about that if you could.
Yeah, so I think, the next book I'm, if I can ever get back to it from like committee work that I'm working on is sort of more focused on the good life and other values like beauty and excellence is having independent value and something that I think both of them are values that we haven't given enough attention to. And I just, there are so many people who, they're not wired. I once told a family member, I don't think you're ever going to be happy. They're a striver. They're like really good at what they do and they do worthwhile, important work. But they're kind of wired for a stressful kind of flying close to the edge kind of thing, a little bit like Honnold. I'm like, I don't think that's how you're wired. And by the way, nobody ever wants to be told, I think, that they're never going to be happy, I guess. At least, I don't tell that to people anymore. But but it is like, I know there are things like I think meditation can do a lot of good. But I also know people, I'm not going to advise them to do anything to be happier. They may not be super happy, but they're happy enough. But I do think we as a society could do better, for instance, just things that can make life less stressful so people aren't. I mean, when I looked at the data for like rural Missouri, people are stressed out exactly as you'd expect with the opioid epidemic and what you see the political agitation there. people have hard lives there, and now what's the best way to deal with that? That's another matter.
Can I interrupt for a second?
I think I'm steering away from your question.
Yeah, hang on. Yeah. I'm going to interrupt for a second. I wanted to ask you something else before I forget, because I think it's really important. So I agree with all that. I mean, I think it'd be great if our culture was a little more, was quote, healthier. You know, we'd all disagree about what exactly that is. You know, some older people like myself would say spend less time on screens. Younger people would say, "What are you talking about? Screens are great. You're out of it." But you know, I'd say spend more time. When I look at a party or a bus or other, not a bus, not a good example, strangers. But if I look at a party or a dinner and I see everybody looking at their phone, I find that something sad about that. But the part of the economist in me says, "Well, it's their choice." But part of it is cultural, and I think you can have healthier versus less healthy cultures about what's expected, what are the norms. And I think those norms are evolving, you know, even now as these technologies become a bigger part of our life. But the real question I wanted to ask you is and we'll come back, we're going to come back to consumers and appreciators, but the real question I wanted to ask you is that, you know, when I look back at my 21-year-old self or my 25-year-old self or my 35-year-old self, and I say, what do I wish I knew then? And so for the listeners out there who are 21, 25, and 35, a part of what I wish I'd known then was what really thoughtful people in human history had to say about happiness and the good life. And to the extent I had any grasp of that, it came from my very modest religious training at the time and my knowledge of literature and my taste of philosophy. But I would think that if I were to advise that 21-year-old, my 21-year-old self, I'd say, you know, read more Aristotle, read more Tolstoy, and don't read the latest research on happiness that says happiness is 37% this and 42% that. You know, I saw a recent talk from Arthur Brooks on that, and I thought, that's not the way I think about it. You know, he says the three factors and what percentages they contribute to your happiness. You know, I think that modern, quote, scientific approach is incredibly unscientific. I think it's scientism. I think it's fake science. And I think we would learn more about how to live from grappling with the great ideas and questions that have humans have struggled with since time immemorial, and less about looking at, quote, research. So, you know, I think Adam Smith can teach you how to be happy. I think Aristotle can teach you how to be happy and how to have a meaningful life. And of course, every person's different. Your weighting of meaning versus physical sensual pleasures can be different than mine. And then finally, we have this whole question that Agnes Callard wrote about and has talked to her about on Econ Talk about aspiration. The idea that, and you talk about it in passing in the book, that maybe we should be aspiring to be somebody we're not. And to think that we're not now and somebody we could become. So to me, those are the things that make for a meaningful and a life of satisfaction, what I would call a life of contentment, which I think is much more important than happiness. So, you know, as a philosopher, you want to defend the liberal arts approach to these questions?
Absolutely. Coming back to the policy side of it, I think I have hopes on the one hand that maybe urban planning could help us build better communities. I don't know. You know, the data.
Good luck with that.
Isn't
but
quite
it's a
there
thought.
Yet.
Definitely a thought.
It's a thought. it's certainly anyway. But more to your point. But I think in educational settings in the schools, this is one area where we could do a much better job. I think there's value in positive psychology interventions like gratitude, you know, count your blessings and things like that. What I think would be more useful, and I think at least giving kids some exposure to, you know, breathing and meditation techniques and seeing if that's for them. It's not for everybody, but it can be very beneficial. I actually think having them read Aristotle, having them read, I mean, the Stoics, you know, after going through some really kind of irritating committee work, has like got out my Marcus Aurelius, you know, the Meditations, you know, the Stoic emperor of Rome. And there's a lot of wisdom in there. And that is, and what's nice about the yes, in the liberal arts and what you get in reading the canon and just generally great works is you get a really human, mature perspective on life and how things really fit together in human life and the complexity of it. The science, I think, is invaluable, but and there's some very bad science. I mean, the stuff about percentages, the pie charts, I just think that's a joke. it's so mistaken. But there's a lot of really good science being done also. But you know, that's not, yeah, reading the studies is not going to do that much for you. I think what's happening is it's telling us, for the most part, things that, oh, it's reminding us, oh yeah, look, relationships really are as important as grandma said. Things like that. So, but I think, yes, good liberal arts education, get it in the K-12 curriculum, get kids really thinking about how to live, so that they have, for one thing, they feel like the culture has given them permission to pursue whatever what they really care about, not just money and stuff and status.
No, I think
if they want to pursue those things, then you know they can do that too.
You know, my take, and I don't know if this is my take today on Thursday at 12:15 p.m. I am increasingly drawn to the idea, as I have been for a number of years, that our natural impulses often or occasionally do not serve us well. And part of growing up and part of maturity is understanding that and appreciating it and looking for techniques to overcome them. Some of them are obvious. These are trivial things. Overeating, consuming things that are bad for you that you regret once you've consumed them. But those are, you know, we tend to focus on those because they're kind of obvious. But I think the bigger questions are the ones that you and I are grappling with implicitly in this conversation, which are making time for friends, making career decisions to keep in mind things other than just how much money I'm going to make and how good I'm going to feel in the short run. And then deeper questions like, and I want to get to this point in your book about, you know, getting outside oneself. And I can't emphasize enough how important that is and how it's incredibly unnatural. Our natural impulse is to be full of ourselves, to see ourselves as the center of the universe. And I think, you know, religion is one way that you avoid that problem or can, but not the only way. So, you know, I'm not suggesting you should be religious because it'll help you get outside yourself. But if you are religious, you will have a means to get outside yourself. If you're not religious, find a different way. Volunteer, join a community, do things that where you contribute rather than are the star of the show. And I think the awareness that you want to be the star of the show and that you'll be often happier, more satisfied, more content if you're not the star of the show is part of what I think a liberal arts, a good education can achieve. And I don't think it's a little bit of a policy question, but I mostly think it's a cultural issue. And I think, you know, what your book does, and I think very thoughtfully and artfully, and what I've been trying to do recently on Econ Talk is to encourage people to think about those things. Because I think they're really what matter, not whether you had a good plan to for your career to get that law degree. Anyway, I'm going to get off my soapbox.
I totally agree. I think one of the troubling trends in recent years is measures of narcissism. I haven't really studied narcissism literature very much, so, but they've been going up and people just reporting more, just seem to be more focused on themselves in recent years. And then anecdotally, that seems plausible. And I think that's, you brought up the consumer appreciator distinction.
Yeah, and, talk about that.
And that's, so I spent the better parts of my youth growing up in to me, it was basically outside civilization on a little island. And tourists would come and visit, and you'd really see a divide in the type of people who would come. There's the people who just came, they want to know, entertain me. I mean, they would literally come up, they would walk in and talk to an islander because they had an unusual dialect, and they'd say, speak, just to hear like they're animals. And then there's other people who, and they'd immediately want to change things. Oh, this is so nice, but you know, here's how we could improve it. And instead of, then there's the other type who just like appreciate it for what it is, and like kind of, you know, their first instinct would be to keep their mouth shut and just sort of pay attention and listen and watch and just take in the beauty of it and see that they're engaging with something new and different and meaningful. And I think that having in general that outlook on life, being able to not just see everything as a tool for your gratification of the desires you already have, but appreciating things for one thing, then that can cultivate your desires to something much more gratifying. I'm actually an atheist myself, but I really like working at a Catholic Jesuit university where my department is one of the leading places for the study of St. Thomas Aquinas's views, especially in ethics and the good life. And this idea of, at least goes back to Augustine, of happiness or the good life as union with God. Sort of, to me, that I think somehow we need to find ways of finding meaning in our lives, even if we don't have religion, even if we don't have a theistic framework. And I think that idea of, like, I like that idea of union with God, even though I don't believe there's a God to union. There's still good things in the world, and connecting with those things to me is, that's the best kind of life you can have.
It's very well said. And, you know, I totally agree. I think part of I love that tourist experience of consume versus appreciate. You know, you can think of it as sort of, I don't know if you mentioned this, but, you know, contractual versus covenantal, the idea that every transactional, say, versus experiential. You know, everything's a transaction that I want to maximize. This is something else, right? I have trouble with the economic, homo economicus, the sort of parity that we teach our undergraduates, that it's all about what you get out of it, as if that's the measure of well-being, right, or satisfaction. And that's, I think that's grotesque. But the other part that I think is meaningful about your distinction is it reminds us, and I've talked about this occasionally on the program, the importance of just paying attention, the idea of watching, the idea of appreciating, of being aware and experiencing something. I don't want to make it too, you know, I like many things about Zen moments, but you can over-exaggerate the being in the moment thing, and now is the only thing that matters. There's some truth to that, obviously, but I'm trying to say something a little subtler about the way we experience the daily life, whether it's on vacation or just having this conversation, in any conversation. And it's partly just remembering to pay attention. It also is something, as I mentioned earlier, it doesn't come natural to us. Paying attention is tricky. Meditation is one way. Mindfulness is one way to build that skill. But there are other ways. And I think, you know, just thinking about it, reading about it is helpful. And it'll change the quality of your life in ways that are unanticipated, I think, if you've never done that before. And I think it's so easy to go through life without that skill. And I think that's something I would argue is useful for if you want to lead a good life. I think it's a good thing. Pay attention. Notice that someone's sad. Notice that you're hurting someone by what you're doing. Look for an opportunity to express that gratitude that you mentioned. So I just think that's a human art that is underestimated and undervalued.
You just gave me an idea for an assignment for my ethics class. You know, like, have students go and just spend some time, sit someplace, sit in the grass or something, and notice what's beautiful in your environment, or notice things, or sit in a park. Actually, my father did this assignment with his classes. He was a physicist, but he was teaching writing. And it's like, just sit in a park and observe and write your observations. And, you know, when somebody first starts, it might be that they have a really hard time paying attention. They really have to cultivate that ability to pay attention to what's going on. And instead of just sitting there, probably the first thing they want to do is write how they feel.
Yeah. And
why am I doing this?
On a silent meditation retreat I was on, we had to do something like that. We didn't write, but we had to go outside and look at something and look at it for a while. I can't remember what the exact assignment was, but I found myself, it was a bitter cold winter day, and it was in late December. I wandered out into the grounds of the retreat center we were at, and there was a set of bushes, and there were some sparrows in the bushes. And I just watched one sparrow for as long as I could, and as long as that sparrow was around. And it was a remarkably transcendent moment that I, you know, a vivid moment of being alive that stuck with me, obviously. It has no ultimate significance, the fact that I spent whatever it was, 5 full minutes, probably, maybe less, but it felt like a very long time, just watching a sparrow and thinking about a sparrow and the fact that we're on the earth together. And, you know, you could argue that was a stupid waste of time. I didn't feel that way. And it was very vivid. And I think if you could live more of your life that way, one would feel good about that. I do. I don't live it that way much. I can't do it very much. I'm not very good at it. But I think, as you point out, it's a skill. It's something you have to cultivate. You're very bad at it at first. And, that whole idea of it being a skill is so alien. You know, most people would say, well, yeah, some people have a short attention span, some people have longer ones. It's just a genetic. It's just something you're endowed with. I don't think it's true. I think you can change how much you pay attention and how you experience things.
It takes me at least 3 or 4 weeks in a place where I'm just sort of, I'm able to kind of unplug from the regular, you know, the treadmill, where I get to a point, and this island, it's called Ocracoke Island, so they called it Ocracoma, and you might have been there, and it's not that much Ocracoma there in high season anymore, because it's been discovered, and that's great, because they need the tourist dollars, but it is, I mean, you could just sit all day and watch and just do nothing. But if I go there on vacation now, we go for 2 weeks, I've got to get my sailboat working. There's stuff to do. And I'm like, I keep going. I can't sit and watch things for, I could watch something for 5 minutes, but that's tough. Yeah. And I'd have to be there at least a month before I can really, really pay attention and just sit back and just sit there and watch the water for an hour or two or more.
Yeah. Something you said that really struck me. I'd never heard it said this way. You said, what makes living with each other bearable and civilization possible is the willingness of all parties to limit the exercise of their rights. I'm going to read it again. What makes living with each other bearable and civilization possible is the willingness of all parties to limit the exercise of their rights. And you wrote this in the context of, you know, again, what we've sort of been talking about, like, what's in it for me? And that, and I'm entitled to fill in the blank, this idea that well-being for all of us is partly created by our self-restraint is a really beautiful idea. Talk about that.
Well, one of the banes of happiness, well, at least this happiness researcher's existence, has been, you know, that I have a right to be happy, that sort of thing. Like, and that just contributes to this association of happiness with narcissism and selfishness. But I also think, there is this, I guess this is more channeling my role as a moral philosopher, that people often use that the fact that they have a right to do something as an excuse for doing it, as a justification. And like, well, and that's very common, especially in this country. It'd be interesting to see cross-culturally whether, like in Russia or in China, people would talk that way. But And I think it's a very dangerous way of thinking, because we have a right to be jerks. We have a right to be unpleasant. And I think that's good. I think that's an essential part of a free society, is that we aren't, we can't be coerced to be good people, to be decent people. At the same time, then we have to realize, like, what you have a right to do, you know, is a very small part of what, you know, is only marginally related to what you ought to do. And so I have a right to just sit on my butt and not help anybody else and just keep my money and not do anything and never lift a finger for somebody. But what an awful way to go through life. And I think this is, I think one of the things, this may be overreaching a bit, but in our politics, we've had a tendency to leave a lot of the American culture behind by focusing on, say, problems of poverty and disadvantage as the people have a right, and therefore you don't have a right to your income, say, and so it must be, it ought to be redistributed. That might be the right conclusion to draw. I mean, you know, it's not my favorite idea, but you could also say, well, maybe you have a right to your income, but it would be pretty indecent to sit in splendor and not help people in need and not help each other out. And in the conservative parts of America that I've spent a lot of time in, the rural areas, red state areas, looking out for each other and helping each other is as much, I mean, everywhere in the country, people care about helping each other. And, but they don't do it in the language of rights. And I'm changing the subject slightly, but,
no, but I think, you know, there's the sense that, yeah. It's a great point. What I hear you saying is that is this point about ought to and can. So,
yeah,
all of us can help people around us in different ways. Often we don't have enough information to do it well. You know, you talked about giving advice to your family or to a student. It can be very challenging. But when we see someone in distress who's reaching out for help, we don't have to help them. But we can, and some would say we ought to. And I think those are really different things. And I think for reasons I don't fully understand, in America, things that are legal seem to be morally sanctioned. Things that are illegal are not morally sanctioned. And that seems to me to be a very bad calculus. To me, there should be a lot of things that are legal that are immoral. You gave some examples, acting like a jerk, being rude. They're legal. Being hateful, being cruel. Those are many of those things are legal, should be legal, and are bad things to do. Why can't that be the way we think about things? We struggle to do that. So many people think, well, if it's bad, we need to make it illegal. No, that's one way to make the world a better place, is to use the power of the police and the state to stop or deter behavior that's unpleasant or unattractive. But there are other ways: culture, norms, sanctions, personal sanctions, behavior of various kinds. And I think we make the wrong choice when we constantly conflate what is legal with what is moral and vice versa.
I completely agree. Yeah, it's and I just think there's a lot of things we can do, but you know, it would be kind of grotesque for us to just stand by. You know, if you just let your neighbor die in the gutter when you could easily rescue them, that might be your right, but it's just a terrible thing to just do that. And I think that, you know, the moral life is a lot more demanding, and man, it's very different from what legally. I think the law has very little to do with morality. I'm glad we have the law, but
well, let's talk about Peter Singer's example, because I think that's a nice segue. You know, Peter Singer talks about this example where you're walking to work, and you go through a park, and there's a kid drowning in the pond of the park, and you have to decide whether to wade in and save the kid. If you do that, you're going to ruin your shoes. They're $250 nice leather shoes. You might be late for work. You might jeopardize your relationship with your boss. And you know, he argues you have a moral imperative to save the kid. And I agree 100%. It sounds like that's just his example is just a version of what you just said. Your neighbor dying in the gutter. So the kid's dying there. And then somehow that then leads to a set of conclusions that don't follow for me. Like, therefore, if you throw a nice birthday party for your 7-year-old child, you're killing people in Africa because you didn't buy the 39 bed nets to reduce malaria. And for about 47 reasons, I think that's the wrong ethical comparison. But I don't think anybody disagrees that you ought to ruin your shoes to save the kid. Whether you should be obligated by law to save the kid is a different question. And then, of course, the last thing I want to add, and I got this from a listener who sent me, I can't apologize to that listener, I can't remember his name, but he said, well, yeah, if every day you waded in and saved somebody from that pond, isn't that going to start to change how parents treat their kids and how careful they are and how kids behave?
Yeah.
Isn't it just a little more complicated? The answer is, yeah, it is. So anyway, what do you think about that?
I agree. I'm not a fan of utilitarian moral reasoning. You know, it captures some part of our moral thinking, and I think Peter Singer has done a great job of calling our attention to some difficult moral puzzles. Like, yeah, what should we be doing for other people and animals and so forth? At the end of the day, though, I think there's just a big difference between what you do and what you allow to happen, that we have special obligations to the near and dear. And I think, and there's a difference between even, say, the drowning kid. Yes, I agree that we need to, that we have an obligation to help, and it would be indecent not to. But it's different from, say, saying that the child has a right. I mean, this is a terrible example because it sounds like I'm saying somehow trying to argue against the kids getting helped. Think of the difference between if you're a lifeguard and you're on the payroll and it's your job to rescue someone who's drowning. If you refuse, it seems to me like you owe a compensation, like you have failed. The person's entitled to your rescue, to your aid. Yeah. I don't think that's the case necessarily, or at least it's not obviously the case, just in an ordinary situation where you're just a random bypasser. And if you refuse to help, you've still done something wrong, I think. It's still morally indecent. What kind of person would just do that? Nobody should want to be the kind of person who just walk by and let somebody drown. But it doesn't seem to me like you owe them compensation. It doesn't seem like their need automatically creates an entitlement. This is getting deep into political philosophy
it's a great observation. I think it makes the point that you and I think, and probably most of us listening, would like to live in a world, not a world, because that might be too hard, but live in a community where we watch out for each other in situations of duress like that. That if my child, God forbid, was drowning in that pond, I hope you'd save them. And I'd want to live in a place where I know children might be helped in those situations so that I could let my child run free at risk of sometimes hurting themselves, knowing that others would, you know, it's just such an obvious point about something much larger than the law, the power of the state, versus and the idea of what you're entitled to. So you're not entitled that your child be saved. It's that you choose to join a community, or you'd like to live in a community where your child would be saved. And that's not the same thing as, I don't want to live in a community where there's a law that you have to save children. That means that the community's bonds are incredibly weak, and the culture that might otherwise save that child doesn't exist. And to think you're going to substitute the power of the state to do that, and that's you're right, it's political philosophy speaking here. I think that's a bad alternative. I don't think it works. I don't think it works very well. I think it's a bad, for very Hayekian reasons, by the way, that the state can never have the information about that in any one situation that's necessary to judge it that way. I mean, much better to let the people on the ground who have the full information make that decision by internalizing some of the care that we're talking about in a healthy society or healthy community. And I explicitly said not the world, because I don't think you can have that level of care about strangers that are alien to you, perhaps, in many ways. And I think that's the virtue, you know, of religious community, national community, local community. And I just think we don't appreciate those things sufficiently.
Yeah. I mean, I would say I have a more expansive idea of the appropriate role of government, although I also I don't think the answers are obvious here, but I think it is important for people to understand that it's possible to argue for things like, say, well, maybe the government should provide, there should be universal health care, say. That's something you may not agree with,
I don't really disagree with it. It's a horrible idea, but yeah. But I just have to add the footnote, which I started to add recently, which is, even though I think it's a horrible idea, it's imaginable to me that it could be better than our current horrible system. So, you know, I'm open to a marginal improvement there, but it will never be my ideal as a government law because of, for a lot of reasons, economic consequences, incentives, et cetera. But go ahead. Sorry to interrupt. I just had to get that in.
I think people on the left have alienated a lot of fellow citizens by acting as if the only way to argue for that is to say that healthcare is a right, is an entitlement. And you could just say, well, whether or not it's a right, it's something that if we're affluent enough, if we have the ability to do it, and this is where Hayekians would come in and say, well, maybe it's not going to work so well.
Right, yeah.
But if we have the ability to do it, then we should. We have an obligation to, because for the same reason that we should rescue the child drowning in the pond. Now, of course, saying that the government should be the instrument of that raises special questions, which I won't try to answer here. But
no, that's a great.
I'm not sure I have answers offhand. But
well, that's a great caveat, because I think, you know, that's my caveat. I'm in favor of universal health care too, just not mandated as through the Medicare program or anything like that. I certainly want to live in a world where everyone has access to superb health care, even when they can't afford it. But I don't believe that has to be provided through a government agency. So that's a great – I'm really glad you added that.
So, and I think this one – and you and I would probably be on different sides of that caveat, but the caveat has to be made because it's a further question. And it's not always obvious. I do think, I at least I'm kind of in that boat. Well, it's hard to imagine how we could do much worse than we're doing now.
Well,
the amount of money we're spending.
In terms of bang for the buck, it's certainly hard to imagine.
Yeah.
We do have, I think, a rather remarkable healthcare system in its over provision of excellence. You know, we have too much of it, way too much of it, in certain dimensions, and not enough in others. And the incentives are messed up that have created that world. You know, having said that, it does reward innovation. It over-rewards it. So most of the world enjoys many things out of the pockets of U.S. taxpayers because we have funded the incentives that create that innovation that other people get at a different price than we do. And so it's a disturbing system in so many ways. But anyway.
I think that's a question that hasn't gotten enough attention is, drug prices are really high here and they're lower elsewhere, but maybe they're lower elsewhere because we're subsidizing, essentially cheap prices in other countries.
Yeah, we are. Let's close with, let's talk about the good life. You know, we've been bouncing around that topic really the last, you know, part of this conversation. You close your book with a short list, which is impressive, of how to find the good life. What do you You said you don't like to give advice, but you kind of do in that part of the book. So,
yeah.
And I appreciate it, actually. I think it's nice to hear what people think is relevant for the good life. Go ahead.
So I wanted to include that because at the end of the day, people, I think people are really looking to say, well, what do I do? Right. And that's really, answering that kind of question is kind of anathema for a philosopher, you know, my sensibilities. But I think, you know, starting a list at least is, my hope is that that would be something that would stimulate readers to think about their own lists and what they would add or what else they would have. But, I forget what other items I thought about putting on and didn't put on, but connecting with other people, is especially important now. Just with the new technology and the smartphones and so forth, which I love the gadgets, but I think you hinted at this before. I think we're going to develop norms, and we are developing norms to make life tolerable with them. But it really is, and I'm hearing from other educators, like just mental health well-being among college students has like really been cratering in recent years. I think it's not just the technology. I think it's a variety of factors, but just the decline of their social lives. And actually debt was kind of I guess philosophers aren't really supposed to talk about debt, but it really is, and part of it is I was imagining one of my nieces or nephews, in college, they graduate or whatever, and maybe they pick it up and read and like, yeah, stay out of debt, man. I mean, debt has a place, but don't go crazy with it. Don't, don't make yourself unfree where you can't lead the kind of life you want. And there was, relax.
Yep.
Now, I admittedly am on the... Ocracoma side of things. I really like a friend of mine who worked with a tribe in Nicaragua, he said they had a special term for this. Their favorite activity was basically, he said, translates as watching paint dry, but it's watching the river flow.
Or watching the sparrow.
Doing nothing. Watching the sparrow.
Yeah.
And that, I think being able to do that, and that as a parent, it's something I really... like, let's get out camping once in a while. Let's get out and do things where, so at least none of us forgets how to just pay attention to things and relax for at least a little bit. And I think the last bit was, this is something, my dad gave a talk to Unitarian Society many years ago on, my great-grandmother, Zeta McClure, had lots of aphorisms. That's the piano, piano behind me was bought by her father like in 1890. It's been like the only thing that survived in the family through boom and bust. And she said basically at the end of the day, what really matters is making it come out even. And philosophically, it's totally crude, but it's the idea that you feel like you at least, the idea is that you did your part, and that when you come to the end, you kind of feel like, you did enough. You held up your end of the deal. You didn't leave a mess. And I kind of like to think of it in terms of, this is a Kantian thing, really, the conversation test, it's contractualist, this idea that, can you imagine sitting down with the people who've been in some way touched by your life and look them in the eye and feel okay, just feel justified, and that you could justify to them the way you've led your life. And to me, I think that's a good test. And I it's hard to know how to answer that because the people who are touched by us are, many of them are far away. But I think that's, but I also think I'm kind of optimistic. I actually think more people could give a decent, a good answer to that question than think. I think we tend to over-moralize and Like I bet if people disagree with that book, probably the biggest thing would probably be with my suggestion that most people lead pretty decent lives and are morally pretty decent people. And I'm pretty optimistic that way, but and obviously we could be doing better, but we could all, you know, but I do actually think most people have good lives. I may be a Pollyanna there. I could be, but
I think there's something. Yeah. What I liked about that, I had a quibble or two with it. We don't need to talk about. It was mainly the use of the word even. But I knew what you meant, and I knew what your grandmother meant.
I'd like it to be better than even.
Yeah,
actually,
I know that, yeah. But that's what she meant. That's what she meant. And I knew that was what you meant. But when I think of Thoreau. The massive men lead lives of quiet desperation. And I think that's the sort of half empty view of the glass.
Yeah.
more than half empty, right? And yet somehow, but he's onto something there. Life is hard in a certain existential sense. Not, we're very blessed, you and I, and many of our hundreds of millions of people in the modern world have very easy lives. There's not much quiet desperation of the kind that Thoreau meant, but maybe it is because all the pain and struggle that we and suffering, a lot of it now is what is called first world problems. The things that that people in the past would be thrilled to have as their source of difficulty, but we all still have that. Doesn't matter how rich we are, we still struggle with those aspects of our humanity. And I think there's something incredibly heroic about the human enterprise that most of us manage to do our part anyway. You know, we face those challenges, and most of the time we rise to the occasion. We take care of each other, not always, not perfectly, not at the level that others might ask of us, but we do our what we often feel is our best. And yes, we could do better, and yes, part of life is figuring out what better is and how to get there from here, but there's a triumphant aspect of the human condition that I think is easily missed that I hear you talking about.
I agree, and I think, and it really is across human history. I mean, I certainly have. I just read a story about people at a life-saving station on the Outer Banks in 100 years ago. Going out and rowing 9 miles out into a February storm, all of them with the flu, to rescue people from a ship. And they were out there for 28 hours with no food or anything, freezing and and waves crashing on them. And okay, that's tough. My life is much easier than that. But you see, there's lots of distress among, I'm not confident in the affluent communities around me, that there isn't a lot of distress and a lot of suffering there too. And people tend to think, well, rich people have it easy. Nobody has it easy.
Yeah.
Life is just, it's a struggle for everybody pretty much. I mean, some people are born lucky materially and with the inner nature and everything does, but everybody has the struggle. It's a little easier for some and harder for others, but it's a struggle. And I just think it's, to me, it's a privilege. I love studying humankind. We do some pretty awful things, but it's the negativity bias. We tend to focus on the awful things more than the good things.
My guest today has been Daniel Habron. His book is Happiness, A Very Short Introduction. Dan, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Thank you, Russ.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.